Too much. In presenting Ambassador Levy, you should know that he's an expert in monasticism. Strange, but for an ambassador of Israel to the Holy See, he is a historian and an expert in monasticism. And this should be very interesting to hear his observations on the role that states play in the construction of peace, especially since he has a very broad view of the relationship of church and state, and also of religious places in the Holy Land. So, Ambassador, thank you.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to stand here in the beautiful, renovated auditorium, which I envy you. It's a very nice one, I think. Secondly, I am well by the many Franciscan guards I see here. I don't recall to have seen them so in so numerous numbers, unless I recall the introitus in Jerusalem several years ago, which was arranged for Cardinal Schönborn. 300 Franciscans were there at Jaffa Gate, so it was all wrong. I'm going to speak on the idea of peace in Judaism, hoping not offending too many people, and hoping that I'm not like Daniel in the lion's den. Because I'm going to reflect on my reservations on the combination between justice and peace. I would rather see them as contradictory terms when it comes to peacemaking. So, we seem to have lately been inundated with a flood of texts related to the Holy Land calling for a just peace. It is enough to point out that the communique of the Church-inspired Holy Land Coordination during its last visit in the Holy Land a week ago, in which the formula of just peace was mentioned in a one-page text no less than five times. It would seem that peace has become a political slogan, flavored with a strong religious undertone, and at the service of whoever chooses to use it in his political language. I would like, with your permission, to examine this term a little more closely, since I feel that it needs more clarification for the sake of common understanding. What is, therefore, a just peace? What does it contain? Is it, in fact, possible? Noumen est omen does not, unfortunately, necessarily reflect reality. With more than 600 attempted coups d'etat there over the last century, La Paz, the capital of Bolivia, is not a city of peace. Neither does Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina, deserves its proper name. And it's difficult to say that Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, has earned the Babylonian name of Jerusalem as a city of peace during its 300 years of recorded history. Visions of peace have been promulgated in Jerusalem since the days of biblical prophets. There has been no lack of ideas and visions until present time. Christianity permeates with the idea of Christ as a Prince of Peace. Judeo-Christian messianic visions of peace have been around ever since the Augustan golden era of the eternal Pax Romana. And they all failed until now because peace has been closely associated with the idea of morality and justice. I would like to explain the roots of my reservations while basing them on Jewish traditional concepts of justice and peace. In Psalms 85, verses 11 to 12, it is said that mercy and truth are met together, righteousness and peace have kissed each other. Truth shall spring out of earth, and righteousness shall look down from heaven. In Hebrew, Chesed ve'emet nifgashu, Tzedek ve'shalom mishaku, Emet mi'eretz tizmach, ve'tzedek mishamayim mishkaf. The Talmudic sages used to identify truth and righteousness with Moses, and mercy and peace with his brother Aaron. With the above quoted psalm in mind, the rabbis conceived the four merits to be in harmony as Moses and Aaron met and kissed each other. The Syrian conflict was covered up with the saying of Rabbi Azaria in the tractate Exodus Rabbah 5.5.10, namely, that we do not know to whom Aaron or Moses God acknowledged more clearly. Rabbi Shimon ben Daniel said once in the Mishnah, Tractate Avot 1.18, that the world stands on three foundations: justice, truth, and peace. I would like to draw your attention to the conflict-oriented dichotomy between peace and justice, which is reflected in the Talmudic thought in the personalities of Moses and Aaron. We remember that Moses stood for truth and justice. Aaron stood for peace and mercy. In Tractate Sanhedrin 6b, Moses appears as one that opted clearly for justice, as it is said, justice will pierce the rock. Aaron, however, opted for peace, as it is said, Aaron the peace seeker installed peace between people. To quote in Hebrew, שנאמר דברים למשפט אלוהים הוא, וכן משה היה אומר, ייקוב הדין את ההר. אבל אהרון אוהב שלום ואוהב שלום, ומשים שלום בין אדם לחברו. Even the elder in Pirkei Avot 1.12 idealized the personality of Aaron and the configuration of a quest for peace. This is a remarkable opinion, bearing in mind that in the biblical story, Aaron also compromised with the people's demand to venerate the golden calf. This dramatic conflict is also the leitmotiv in Arnold Schoenberg's opera, Moses and Aaron. The guideline in Jewish traditional law was always to exercise pragmatism. The sages recommended to judges to always seek a compromise between the conflict partners and not to implement the full authority of justice or legal measures. A relevant example is the case of capital punishment. Even if it was mentioned in the Bible, the Jewish halakha and the legal practice among Jews never practiced it. The only exception, albeit modern, that perhaps highlights the rule was Adolf Eichmann. The Talmud states that a court that has ruled for capital punishment even if only once in 7 years is a bloodthirsty court. Which lesson should we conclude? Justice is not compatible with compromise. Peace can be achieved only through compromise. Hence, I have a big reservation towards the political slogan Just Peace, which is often regarded as a moral yardstick. The Israeli author Amos Oz illustrated his criticism on Just Peace with the following observations. In order to solve the Israeli-Arab conflict, we can choose between a tragic, dramatic end a la Shakespeare and a tragic, comic end a la Chekhov. In Shakespeare's drama, all protagonists remain righteous and faithful to their moral principles, but by the time the final curtain falls, they lie dead on the floor. In Chekhov's drama, For the third and fourth, they are all lying frustrated and unhappy on the floor, but alive. If these are the prospects of a national conflict in which each side sticks to its own right and historical narrative, how much more complicated it must be to achieve a solution in a religious conflict on both sides. If the adherence towards morality and justice impedes the way to a compromise, how can we expect to achieve a compromise on matters of belief? In addition to this truism, I offer an additional consideration. Not only that peace is a result of a pragmatic compromise, it will come about after all other alternatives have been tried and failed. Peace will not be achieved as a first option, but only as an ultimate option after the involved parties reach the state of mutual exhaustion. The idea of peace in Judaism is no glorification of belligerency, but is far from being unconditional pacifism. The term shalom, peace, is mentioned 135 times in the Old Testament. It appears as a cosmic vision of universal peace in the books of the prophet. The most known vision is that of Isaiah 2:4, and he shall judge among the nations and shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Universal peace in Judaism belongs to the eschatological vision, which will be implemented with the coming of the Messiah. As long as the Messiah has not come, the coexistence of mankind will remain imperfect. It will have to be administrated as good as possible, in spite of the prevailing shortcomings of a sinful human race. Jewish ethics universally sanctify the human life of any member of mankind, regardless religious affiliation. Life-saving measures precede and cancel the observation of the Shabbat or even the fasting on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. Judaism knows, however, the concept of martyrdom since the apocryphal story of Hannah and the seven children during the Hasmonean era. The idea of Jewish martyrdom reoccurs in periods of existential crisis, such as during the Crusades and in the Nazi extermination camps. It does not belong to the mainstream in Jewish thought and appears alongside eschatological messianic expectations. In Jewish thought, one can distinguish between Milchemet Mitzvah, just war, or literally a war of duty, and Milchemet Reshut, a war of choice. The first type is a war prescribed by God, and it refers to the biblical wars of land-taking of Canaan in the books of Joshua and Judges. The second type is an optional war in which a conflict of interest is fought out. Such a war cannot be decided upon by the ruler alone. It requires the consent of the Sanhedrin, which acts as a check and balance system. Since the Talmudic era and the period of Jewish dispersion, the legal discourse on belligerency was highly theoretical. Jews ceased to have instruments of power and coercion in their hands. The establishment of the modern state of Israel in 1948 has changed the parameters of discourse on war and peace. Traditional concepts of conduct between men to men were applied to relations between greater collectives or communities. It seems to me that the right of self-defense has gained a certain level of actuality. One could easily find a halakhic application in the Talmudic law, Tractate Brachot 58, Brachot 62, or Sanhedrin 72. The right of self-defense appears three times. If someone comes to kill you, be alert and kill him before. In Bala Hargecha, Hashem Lehodgo. Without doubt, to sum it up, we have here a set of events telling us that before the arrival of one form of Messiah or another, just peace is an unattainable goal, unless, of course, we divorce the two words being used, justice and peace. For justice for one party seeking peace could be seen as undermining justice for another party seeking the same peace. We have in short an impossible formula, one that only a divinely sent individual could make sense of. In the meantime, the best we mere humans can do is to administer the best possible crisis management that provides the largest amount of good for the largest amount of people. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador. Passing on now to our ambassador from Ireland, who before coming to Rome was ambassador in the United States. And coming from Ireland, a land where we know the history of the role of religion and also the conflicts that have arisen, we look forward to listening to Noel Lay for the interpretation given of the role of religion in finding peace.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be invited to speak at this university. Franciscan Order has had a very, very long relationship with Ireland, with the Catholic Church in Ireland, which has played a major role not only in the history of the Catholic Church in Ireland, but also the history of Ireland and Irish culture. It's always useful when you're a Master of the Holy See, Irish Ambassador of the Holy See, to pay the occasional visit to St. Isidore's, the Irish Franciscan Foundation, to be reminded of the great Irish scholars who lie in the crypt of the chapel of the Franciscan House in Rome, and the very important part that they played in preserving Irish culture at a very difficult time in the 17th century, and indeed in creating a literary and popular literary culture in Irish that survived to this day. So it's always an honor and a pleasure to speak in a Franciscan house. And of course, I had an uncle who was a Franciscan friar, whom I remember with great affection. And I'm told when I first saw him and saw the slash of brown habit, I yelled loudly, and that's it, I don't have to do that anymore. So it's a bit of a pleasure, both from a historic and a personal point of view, to be here. It's difficult to follow Mordecai's address, which sadly, in my view, covers conflict that continues. It's somehow, perhaps in a way, a little bit less challenging to deal with a conflict that is over than God. So, but it's a pleasure for me, I suppose, from that point of view, to be able to talk from a more positive, perhaps, viewpoint, or a more positive experience, and perhaps, to borrow from Mordecai, from a conflict where perhaps Chekhov, in the end, proved to be more appropriate than Shakespeare in describing the conflict. I'd like to cover four particular aspects of the conflict in Northern Ireland. I'd like to cover the background in Irish history. I'm sorry, it'll have to be a brief tutorial on Irish history, but in context. I'd like to talk about the conflict itself. I'd like to talk about the role of religion in the conflict. And to finish, I'd like to say something about ecumenism, the part that ecumenism played in helping the churches in Ireland come to terms with the conflict and helping them indeed to make their contribution to bringing conflict to an end. Ireland is a country that's had a very difficult religious history, and it's a country where religion became identified with nation on the one hand, and national loyalty, and on the other hand, with economic dominance. A very explosive and dangerous combination involving concepts, not only of peace, but very much concepts of justice and fair treatment. At the Reformation, the majority of the Irish remained loyal to the Catholic Church, though there were significant minorities who went with Anglicanism and with the Reformed churches, especially with Presbyterianism. From the 17th to the 19th century, Irish Catholics were subject to persecution and discrimination on the island as a whole. Much of the history of 19th century Ireland is about the reversal of that discrimination and the battle for equal rights. This struggle inevitably helped to heighten tension and to drive the churches apart. The afterglow of the Reformation persisted in Ireland well after it had died down elsewhere in Europe. At independence in 1922, most of the island formed an independent state, but the northeast of the island remained part of the United Kingdom. The religious situation in two parts of Ireland is very different. In the independent part of Ireland, essentially the south, and the West, about 90% of the population profess to be members of the Catholic Church. Another 5% are members of Protestant churches. In Northern Ireland, Northeast on the other hand, 60% of the population is Protestant, 40% is Catholic. Religion played a vital and defining part in the fact that when independence came in 1922, the majority in Northern Ireland wished to remain under British rule. Ironically, and despite the establishment of two political entities on the island, the governance of all the main religious groups in Ireland remained on an all-island basis, and they were not divided in 1922. So in 1922 we had two new states, one of which was founded very much on the principle that the majority, the Protestant majority, did not believe that they would receive justice in a united Ireland, and they held to their allegiance to Britain and remained part of the United Kingdom. So Northern Ireland from the beginning was a state with a very strong sectarian basis, and even though arguably legally that was not the case, it certainly was politically the case for 50 years at least after the foundation of the state in 1922. The South, with the majority Catholic population, became a Catholic country where Catholic social teaching and Catholic principles were inevitably very much part of the law. Nevertheless, the Constitution very specifically guaranteed the rights of various religious denominations, including the Jewish community, when it was adopted in 1937. It's interesting, just as an aside on that, that 1937, at a time when the Jewish community in Europe was increasingly under pressure, in Ireland, the independence of rights in the Jewish community was specifically guaranteed in the Constitution. And these guarantees broadly had a very practical effect. For instance, education in Ireland, in the south, in Ireland, part of Ireland I represent, is very much on religious lines, and both at, certainly very much at an elementary level, but also at secondary level, education in Ireland is based on religion. So, for instance, the crucifix issue, which applies initially, does not apply in Ireland. I mentioned that as an aside to illustrate that the part of Ireland that I represent directly was very much a country where religion counted. To return to Northern Ireland and to return to the conflict, the lack of justice and the lack of civil rights for the minority Catholic population led to constant conflict. And this conflict finally became very, very serious in the late 1960s. The Catholic community were discriminated against in housing and in employment. And this situation finally boiled over in the late 60s into civil unrest and serious violence. That violence continued into the 1990s, and it actually enforced the existing divisions between the communities. On many occasions between 1968 and the late 1990s, Northern Ireland was on the brink of civil war. There were occasions in the early 1970s when it seemed that civil war was unavoidable, and that similar unrest took place in the 1980s. And civil war would have meant large transfers of population, attacks on vulnerable communities, all the horrors we've seen in Europe, sadly, since the fall of communism in the Balkans. All of those horrors could and were feared in Ireland, especially in the 1970s. It's easy to forget now, but those fears did exist. So for nearly 30 years, there was, if you like, a low, to use a phrase used in another context in the 1970s, there was a low intensity war, there was fear of civil war, there was great fear among the population and great distance between Catholics and Protestants on a day-to-day level. Now, it's very interesting that while the conflict was often defined as a religious conflict, the churches stepped back from this, and at no time between 1968 and the ending of the conflict did any of the mainstream churches, and the churches that represent the majority of the population in Northern Ireland, claim that the conflict was fundamentally religious. They stood out against it. They argued that religion had no place in such a conflict and was being used and abused to support the conflict, and by various others involved in it. The mainstream churches were always opposed to violence and certainly objected very strongly to the conflict being presented as a conflict in the name of religion. This steadfast rejection of violence helped, in my view, to prevent the slide into civil war. The fact that on one level, at the leadership level, the leaders of the main churches came out regularly and spoke out against violence helped to create an atmosphere which, in my view, formed a break on the slide to civil war. And of course, for those most directly involved, the clergy of all the denominations, the religious in their communities, it was a day-to-day situation where religious leaders and religious faced every day the challenge of persuading their people, their flocks, not to engage in violence. And this they did with, at least as far as the mainstream churches were concerned, admirable persistence and courage. So to a large extent in the 70s and 80s into the 90s, the churches stood as a fire break which prevented a conflict, a very nasty conflict, becoming a widespread conflict. There were times of individual atrocity when individual clerics stood in the way of those seeking revenge. There were times in the conflict when the leaders also stood in the way. Pope John Paul II, when he visited Ireland in 1979, laid down a very firm marker for the Catholic Church, and one which it adhered to right through the conflict. So, when the movement began towards peace in the late 80s, you had a considerable involvement by individual clerics who had, in the course of their work in their parishes and in their communities, come to understand where the conflict was coming from and earn the trust of those involved in the conflict. And while thinking back on the long process which brought about the agreement and which eventually, in the last decade, led to a devolved government in Northern Ireland with representatives of all the communities, one who had been, such as I, who had been involved to some extent in that process, It's easy to remember the big political set pieces. It's not so easy to remember the important role played by individual priests, individual ministers of religion, in helping to create an atmosphere that brought about peace. To sum up on the religious role in the conflict, and before I finish with ecumenism, I would say that religion played its part in a very positive sense. It responded to claims that religion brought about the conflict by being the force that held it in check and eventually brought an end to it, or helped bring an end to it. I think believing in peace, as so many religious did in the 70s and 80s, on the prompting of Pope John Paul II, by believing in peace, they had to create peace. Can I just finish by mentioning ecumenism? Ecumenism came to the fore, I suppose, after the Vatican, Second Vatican Council. Before that, there was very little direct involvement between the Catholic Church and the Anglican and Reformed communities in Ireland. They tended to keep their distance. But interestingly enough, historical parallel, historical coincidence is interesting. The churches had a chance in the mid 1960s to come together in the ecumenical movement, to get to know each other. And I think this experience created personal contacts and confidence in each other in the very long various religious meetings that enabled them to speak out with confidence and trust in each other when the conflict broke out in the late 60s. I think that ecumenism in that broad sense, because the churches were learning to work together, had a hugely beneficial effect in bringing church leaders together in the face of the conflict of violence in Northern Ireland. On another level, ecumenism has been active in bringing communities together. The Irish School of Ecumenics, I would mention, is one example. There are other communities, Corrymeela and Glencree, communities in Northern Ireland and in the South, who work to bring individual communities, individual parishes together in ecumenism. So, in one sense, in a major public way, that's by bringing the leaders together, ecumenism played an important part in helping to create the atmosphere that allowed religion to play such a positive part in bringing an end to conflict. But also on the micro level, on the parish level, I think that ecumenism is a significant force. It's good, and I feel it's great in these days to have a positive story. There is a positive story. There is a functioning government in Northern Ireland now which brings together all the communities, the Protestant and Catholic. They've learned to work together, they've learned to work as a government. They deal with the day-to-day issues that governments have to deal with, public spending, water supply, that kind of issue. It's a long way from the miserable and frightening periods of the 70s and 80s when violence was endemic and widespread in Northern Ireland. And in that context, it's interesting to see that the relations between that government and the various religious leaders are on practical issues, issues like education, issues like health, and that the religious leaders are speaking up on issues of social justice and bringing these issues to the attention of government. I end by saying that not everybody involved in the conflict in Northern Ireland got what they wanted, but what people got was peace, and what they got was justice. At least they accepted the justice. They might both have individual long-term names that are different, but they were prepared to accept and borrow from Mordecai that the outcome is better to be Jacobian than Shakespearean. Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Fain. Our next ambassador, His Excellency Miguel Diaz from the United States, is a trained theologian. One holy gentleman was teaching at a Benedictine faculty before coming here, but that's okay, so do I. So I think he will surprise you also by his knowledge of the Franciscan tradition, especially his work in Hispanic themes of theology, especially systematic theology. Dr. Lee.
For a long time, I've had a conversation between the Benedictines and the Franciscans. And we all know that at the time of Benedict, Francis and Benedict's, the Benedictines and the Franciscans have always had this long history together, so I won't take sides and, before a room full of Franciscans. But I will say that I've had a long tradition also with Franciscans. And a number of them I number as part of almost my family. Back in 2005, I had the opportunity to address Franciscans in the United States on a keynote that I offered in California, in San Diego, to the Franciscan Federation. And so for many, many years, I have been very involved with Franciscans in the work of peace and in the work of justice. So thank you for having me here this morning. And thank you to my colleagues, and thank you to each of you who has taken up this work to continue the work of peace. In various parts of the world, the human family is going through a crisis in self-understanding. Once again, communities are asking age-old questions of identity. Who am I? Who are my neighbors? How can I affirm my particular identity within a globalized world? To whom am I accountable? Should I engage others who are different than I am? And if so, should I embrace their otherness? Is peaceful coexistence with those who belong to different political, cultural, and religious traditions possible? Or must we resign ourselves to endless conflict? These are just some of the central questions that we must address as communities and nations if we are to succeed in promoting the common good. Fears related to particular persons and communities and our failure to embrace authentic human differences often drive us apart. In many parts of the world, these fears have precipitated rejection and persecution of others. New threats to peace have emerged from war, terrorism, ethnic cleansing, religious conflicts, poverty, increased human migrations, and climate changes. Paradoxically, an age widely characterized by interdependence and a growing sense of our diversity, an age when distant communities can relate via cyberspace at the simple touch of a mouse pad. It is also an age marked by growing fear of and conflict with others. John Sisulas puts it this way, and I quote, "The fact that the fear of the other is pathologically inherent in our existence results in the fear not only of the other, but of all otherness. This is a delicate point, which I think requires serious consideration. For it shows how deep and how widespread the fear of the other is. We are not afraid simply of a certain other or others. But even if we accept certain others, we accept them on condition that they somehow are like ourselves. Radical otherness is anathema. Difference itself is a threat. That this is universal and pathological is to be seen in the fact that even when difference does not in actual fact constitute a threat for us, we reject it simply because we have distaste or dislike for it. To take an example, even if a person of another color is not threatening us in any way, we reject him or her on the basis of sheer difference. This is an example, as we would all tend to agree nowadays, but there are so many more subtle examples that show how the fear of the other is in fact nothing but the fear of the different. We all want somehow to project into the other the model of our own selves, which shows how deeply rooted in our existence the fear of the other is. End of quote. Religious voices, and in particular religious communities, have a central role to play in helping civic leaders address these challenges and effect reconciliation among peoples. Back in 2005, in a keynote speech I offered to the Franciscan Federation in the United States, I argued that at a time characterized by militarism, conquest, moral corruption, religious tensions, and abuse of power, Francis and Claire rejected violence and exclusion and opted instead for conversion, conversation, and hospitality towards others. I argued then, and I repeat now, that the story of Francis's conversation with the Sultan and encounter with Islam offers a roadmap for encountering and learning from the goodness of others and their distinct otherness. Similarly, shaped by years of living with Benedictine communities, I have also pointed out that the values of community and hospitality to the stranger, so central to the Benedictine tradition, has much to offer to the world in which we live. There is a hidden treasure, yet to be discovered, in the wisdom of Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and other religious traditions that can help us to address the signs of our times. Speaking to the Clinton Global Initiative on September 22, 2009 about Afghanistan and Pakistan, President Barack Obama argued that, quote, "We need to build new partnerships across regions and religions, and that requires religious leaders and NGOs, citizens, to help build the good governance and transparent institutions and basic services upon which true security depends." In his acceptance speech relative to the Nobel Peace Prize, the President acknowledged the hard truth of violent conflict in our lifetimes and the need at times to use force to protect human lives. But President Obama underscored that he made this statement mindful of what Martin Luther King Jr. had said in the same ceremony years ago before him, that, quote, "Violence never brings permanent peace," end of quote. "It solves no social problem, it merely creates new and more complicated ones." The President argued that he was, quote, "living testimony to the moral force of nonviolence," as an African American, and that he knew that there was nothing weak, nothing passive, nothing naive in the greed and lies of Gandhi and King. Martin Luther King Jr.'s memory and legacy we just celebrated yesterday. In October, Pope Benedict XVI will host a summit of world leaders in Assisi to discuss how they can better promote peace. This will be an opportunity for religious leaders to gather and reflect upon how they can help foster greater understanding within the human family. leaders have achieved much success in conflict resolution and promoting peace. Take, for instance, the work of Caritas in Rwanda and in north of Congo. Caritas has led tremendous efforts and has succeeded in promoting inter-ethnic relations. Similarly, thanks to the community of Sant'Egidio, a number of national conflicts have been resolved. This morning we heard 12 examples of ongoing and past efforts by religious communities. These are just a few examples that witness how religious leaders can help communities overcome conflict, welcome authentic human differences, increase mutual understanding, and build peace. They offer proof that governments around the world have much to gain by partnering with religious leaders. Of course, through our history, we have also witnessed the dark side of religion. Not everything that passes as religion, and not everyone who claims to be religious, builds up the common good. The history of misrepresenting religion, oftentimes exemplified by individuals who have abused and acted against others in the name of God, should not become the test case for deciding the value and effective role of religious leaders in the world. On the other hand, as a result of radical forms of secularism, the contribution of religious leaders is also oftentimes rejected. My friends, today, in this age of interdependence, the work of turning interfaith and meaningful worldly conversations into constructive actions cannot be done by any government or religious entity alone. Speaking as the U.S. Ambassador to the Holy See, I want to conclude by saying that much has been accomplished in the last 27 years of our formal diplomatic partnership. Still, much more can and should be done to advance the cause of peace by bridging the varied and diverse resources of the United States of America with the vast network of peace-building efforts associated with the Catholic Church. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Diaz. Our last ambassador this morning is Ambassador Anne Lay from Canada, French-speaking Canada. An expert in economy, but also in Russia. She's had many ambassadorial postings, especially in Africa, Central Africa, the Great Lake region, in the Soviet Republic also, and in countries of Eastern Europe. And she comes to us with vast experience, especially in the area of economics. And so we invite her to speak, Ambassador Anne Lay.
Thank you very much. I thought I'd do something a little different and build on the building blocks of all those who spoke before me. My experience in the Great Lakes region is really what I want to talk to you about. For 3 years, I was the Canadian negotiator, but also the co-chair of the group of friends of the countries of the Great Lakes region. We have here Bishop Fridolin Abongo Bisungu, who spoke yesterday, and we had a chance to chat just now. There are, of course, many issues that illustrate the theme of today. Essentially, this conference brought together the Democratic Republic of Congo and all its neighbors, and Kenya, in order to build links regionally to help stabilize the peace processes in the Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, and even if you look at Uganda to help with the local conflicts there between the Lord's Resistance Army, for example. And I would simply like to illustrate some of the principles and statements made earlier today with what I found interacting with various leaders, but also people from the grassroots who were participating in this conference. And I think that Arnold Pearson's five principles are a good starting point. And when he mentioned that the very first one is an assessment of a given situation and proper discernment, it's an obvious thing to say, but it is so difficult. In the 3 years from the formal negotiating period, we started from bringing people together who had been at war just a few months before, practically, to holding a summit of all the region's leaders and coming up with a charter of principles. We spent months trying to get the main countries to agree on what the problems were, to name the difficulties, and then, when those were named, to agree on a common approach to describe them, and most importantly, to agree that everyone had a part, a share of the responsibility in a given situation. It wasn't all inherited from the past, let's say the colonial past, and it wasn't all the fault of one party, but everyone had a share and therefore a stake in committing to find a solution. So assessment and discernment is indeed very important, and I see many of you probably come from some African countries, and you know probably better than I how difficult this may be. The second point Cardinal Turkson mentioned was, in essence, really a need for personal conversion. It is a little difficult to expect everyone else to do the right thing if you are not willing yourself to put yourself on the line and say, well, perhaps I need to change something as well. This is actually probably the heart of the matter and probably the most difficult to achieve, I think, in everything that's been said. I remember being in the office of a minister in Rwanda, where we were sort of making a situation report of how things have been proceeding so far, and he just looked at us and he said, you know, what's really needed is a change of heart. And as long as this doesn't happen, we'll be talking a lot, we'll be making some commitments perhaps, but in practice, things may not change for the long term. So a personal conversion, willing to make a change of heart, is very, very difficult. Because you know immediately that your own interests are at stake, the interests of your family, of the party you represent. You'll have to give up something, most probably. And you're not sure what you'll get in return. This is one of the lessons that I drew from my experience, and I still see that it's probably the most difficult thing to achieve and that needs to be worked on. On the other hand, I must say that to be listening to a minister in a country who has a lot at stake say this, I realized that we were perhaps a little further ahead than I thought, because with the realization then comes the willingness to engage at least to do something about it. Another point that struck me was the third point, which is really summarized clarity about what is our human calling. And Cardinal Turkson went on to talk about whether we are sort of enclosed in our own little world or we realize that we're interconnected. And it really, I think, boils down to human dignity, recognizing the human dignity of each one of us. And here there's something that came to mind immediately that struck me and still strikes me very much. In one of the negotiating groups, we had several, but one on specifically on human rights, we had the following discussion. The pattern for each of the groups is pretty much the same, was to try to identify, first of all, the problems, the causes, and see what practical steps to take from there. And the working documents always started off with a definition of terms. And in the one on human rights, there were a few delegates, but one in particular, a woman from Zambia, who insisted on putting down among the definitions that of woman. Talk about women's rights. And most people around the table were men and really couldn't understand why she was insisting on having a definition of woman. But after she spoke of her experience and described why we needed this, everyone included it without further discussion. But it is a fact, and I understood that you spoke about this or heard about this yesterday. If you look at what's happening, for example, in the eastern part of the Congo, the border area, with the Rwanda, Burundi, and Uganda, the actions of the fate of women and the statistics for rape, you realize that the consideration of woman as a human being, which is what was put in the definition, has to be said. It has to be spelled out. So when we talk about clarity about the human calling, we really talk about human dignity, but in instances of concrete negotiation, you really start by having people realize that a woman has to be treated like a human being, just like a man is treated. You're starting from a very basic point, and it needs to be said. I see people smiling here, but it's a fact. I just want to make a few other points that are perhaps not necessarily linked, but I know that time is getting short. The issue here is ecumenism and the fundamentals of peace. Yesterday, we heard, was the day of Catholic Jewish dialogue. Today is the beginning of Christian Unity Week. In the 3 years I spent on this negotiation for the Great Lakes region, and my main interaction in terms of religious faith, if we put it this way, was with Catholic Muslims. And reflecting on this, and I'll make a big jump here, I'm from Canada, from Quebec. The discourse in my part of the world is rather, what we get yes to mention, is secularism. And I think that in the end, whether you're Jewish, Pentecostal, Catholic, or Muslim, is perhaps secondary. As long as you have respect for the human being, you believe in preserving human dignity, and you believe that human life is the most important thing, I think you have a basis to work on. And that one should not let the fact that whether you go to church or mosque or not at all really be a factor. Miguel mentioned it a little bit. Up until now, I think we obviously focused on the contributions, the positive contributions that religious people or religious faith can make. Unfortunately, in the Great Lakes region, for one area, you could also see how the perverse side of invoking religion or God for purposes of what do you even call it, the power grabbing, because it's entirely rational in some cases, but how this is also a fact of life. But if you have the basic belief that every man and woman deserves to live and correctly, then it doesn't matter, I think, whether you invoke or or how you invoke God. All this to also say that what is really important, I think, is the grassroots, people at the ground level. In our conference, there was an original feature. It did not bring together only officials from various countries, both political or military officials, but it also had a special place. Every delegation had to have representatives of civil organizations, women's organizations, youth organizations. And they brought a different perspective to the conference. And I also realized, and I think the bishop may have talked about this also, that in fact the basic level of trust needed to make sure that people sit around a table and even consider issues in common, this basic level is actually built up among people who live in the same village or the same village across borders, but among individuals who have to work together and who have to survive together. So that NGOs have a crucial role to play, and leaders or religious leaders can talk a lot and have a lot of meaning, interreligious or intercultural, but it's really education at the ground level, in the school, in the bush, which is very important, that everyone is your neighbor, not just the one from your family or your tribe, that there is something called the common good that goes beyond your immediate interest. That sort of very basic instruction, education is to me probably, it's a sine qua non to actually build the conditions for peace and justice. I want to say here that I'm a diplomat accredited to the Holy See, that the Holy See was a member of the group of friends of this conference in the Great Lakes region. And of course it did not bring to the table what the United States or South Africa or other countries did in terms of financial resources or support of that sort, but it certainly did bring a very intimate knowledge of the countries of the region, and knowledge gained through the presence of various religious orders, of various lay groups, everywhere dealing with people victims of internal displacement, of AIDS, of working to fight for the rights around mining areas. And so that in terms of the diplomatic contribution, the Holy See was present and had really something to contribute. So I think from everything that's been said this morning in my experience, I would sum up by saying that the 12 examples given by Francisco Conner are probably the most important. It's the work with the people at the ground level that brings people together, that instills at least one, hopefully, one common awareness of the value of the human life. And it's this that will eventually keep the leaders in check, I think. Thank you very much.
We want to thank all of the ambassadors for their presentation this morning. We do have some time that we'd like to open up to the general participation here to offer a question or so to one or the other of the ambassadors, or all of the ambassadors together. But the only thing is that we would ask that you be very clear and concise and make sure that it is a question so that they can answer also. So we have about 15 minutes. So if someone would like to pose a question, would you raise your hand and someone would bring the microphone to you. Since we have translation, you have to speak also slowly so that that can be translated in either English or into Italian.
ha domande tu?
Mi sto sforzando di pensare.
Can we have one back here? We have a microphone too. Did you stand up so they can do it too?
Good morning, my name is Father Richard Wohl. I am a Canadian, so I thank very much our pastor for coming here as well. Could I just begin by congratulating all of the ambassadors? I think you've done a marvelous job, and I really appreciate it. I think everybody here would agree with that as well. Much of everything that has been discussed turns around the idea also of human rights. Would any of you or all of you dare to define what is a human right?
Surprise, it's always good to go to our forefathers. I think old Hillel gives us a good guideline, which was also, to my mind, the base of Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative. So, never do to others what you don't like to be done to yourself.
The only thing on that is also in terms of liberation, the international community of liberation, but universally recognized fundamental rights. The other thing that I think I would add is that with every right, we also have a responsibility. And so I think that understanding not only that we have fundamental human rights, but that as persons who are relational and are accountable to one another, we need to have a responsibility for one another, which is built upon that definition of the love of God and neighbor. But I think that's a combination of both rights and responsibility is very important as we engage in the ongoing defense of these rights.
Can I just add one point to the very good points that has been made by the two previous speakers on this issue? It's sometimes an evolving situation, but there is a developing corpus of law and practice on human rights. This is particularly true in Europe because of the Council of Europe and the European Court of Human Rights. It's interesting that in Italy, for instance, there's major controversy about a judgment of that court on the right of to show the crucifix in public buildings. In our case, in Ireland, we recently had a very interesting decision, judgment by the court on abortion, which among other things ruled that abortion was not a right that could be asserted in European law. So it's interesting to move from, if you like, the broad definition and the fundamental definitions which Mordecai and Miguel have been able to give, to recognizing that one of the changes in Europe since the war, particularly in Europe, elsewhere also under the UN and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but particularly in Europe because we have a court which has jurisdiction, that the definition of human rights, the specific definition of human rights, has become almost a day-to-day aspect of some of our law. But I just thought I'd make that point. Thank you.
And You stand up, please, and have the microphone.
Gentlemen, si, qui. Oh.
Pier, sei già là uno. Aspetta, c'è già uno, Pier.
I have one question, but concerns Africa, because much of the talks that we have had here these days, much of it really touched part of our life in Africa. But I doubt it's good also that we have the ambassadors here. You work with the Vatican here, but I think you also have influence with your government. I know that some of the countries where you come from make weapons, and they make good money out of these weapons. Now we talk of peace here. I was asking that since you are the ambassadors in some of the countries where we are coming from, weapons are made. Okay, I start again. I was saying that I'm happy that the things that we have shared here yesterday and today touch mostly our life in Africa. And I'm happy that the ambassadors are here that really represent various countries. Especially like maybe to direct maybe my question to the ambassador to the United States. I know there are also other countries that manufacture weapons, for example. We are talking about peace, and weapons are sold in Africa, and even as we talk here now, there are ships loaded with weapons being sent to Africa, and countries make money with these weapons. So we cannot help talking about peace. And we can't stop the manufacture of weapons and this bloody business. Is it possible that you can influence and stop maybe the sale of weapons to vulnerable governments, especially in Africa?
Thanks for the question. I think we have to realize too that there is always a delicate balance between the defense of human beings and those that defend those rights. And so I think it's always very important that that as I said before, in terms of balancing rights and responsibilities, that certainly, when it comes to to law and order, that and those that have the means to defend the different populations, that that those are persons who clearly are responsible parties that will use the various tools that we have before us to defend those rights in a responsible way.
First of all, I think you are completely right, and you may not be aware of it, perhaps, but the last decade has seen a weakness of the state's structures to control weapon exports, which are often so much privatized and acting in clandestine gray zones, which it really becomes a problem of responsibility. To what extent any given state can control, should control, keeping an eye closed, one or two, depends. It is a very delicate issue which one is not talking too much, and I think it should be more in the forefront.
Okay, we'll take the last question before we leave the closing word to the Minister General.
I would like to put a question about the Democratic Republic of Congo. I have read some journal about violence to women. I'd like to have a trust after the analysis, the conference, contact with Congo, Rwanda, Burundi. What are the causes and what solution can we make to put an end on this situation?
There are certain measures that can be taken at various levels. One is to punish those who make violence against women, and that is not beyond the reach of authorities. But actually going out and capturing the perpetrators and bringing them to account, and if found guilty, then punishing them would be a good start. Now, why isn't it done? Because of all sorts of interests at play, but I believe that there's been a little bit of progress in that sense. But definitely impunity and seeing outrageous behavior go unpunished is certainly a deterrent in terms of improving the situation. Another action to be taken, of course, is ensuring security for women who go out and work in the fields, for example, or who go out and gather wood. And security doesn't belong, for example, to MONUSCO in Congo, but it belongs to the village elders, the local leaders. If they make it their business to say women will be protected, there will probably be an improvement. Another avenue is definitely education. Education in terms of perhaps, if we're looking at Eastern Congo, going back to the values of the family, going back to what was transmitted from generation to generation, respect for the woman as mother, provider, as educator for the family. And where is this education provided? It's provided in the school, it's provided at the church, at the mosque, but this has to be revalued and shown as being something to be preserved. And it's perhaps putting greater emphasis on traditions that have always existed, but have tended to be lost or forgotten in periods of great turmoil. So at least three come to mind immediately. Thank you.
I would just affirm what Anne was just, those three points. And certainly this is one of those areas where Secretary Clinton is very actively seeking a change when it comes to the world situation. The empowerment of young women and women in general, because they oftentimes are the poorest of the poor, and they suffer from various forms of marginalization. And so I think there is an area where religious leaders of all different traditions can come together and speak against the violations of basic human dignity. And this is, as an educator, of course, I think the third one is very important. that this is a role that just for one or two persons or for governments. This is clearly one of those areas where I think each and every one of us can make a significant difference.
So we'd like to thank all of you for coming this morning and to share it. And as you can see, that they have a great rapport among themselves as collaborators. And I've always been impressed by the spirit that the Ambassador of the Holy See has, and also the great responsibility that you carry in terms of conveying the position of the Church back to your own governments, but also your government's positions to the Church. So thank you all once again. So at this time, I would like to invite the Minister General of the Friars Minor to come and offer some concluding remarks. Hermano Jose.
Eccellenze, Rettore Magnifico della nostra Università Antoniana, decani, professori, studenti, fratelli, sorelle, amici tutti in Francesco, il fratello universale. Pace bene, peace and good. Shalom Beto. Ringrazio di cuore tutti i partecipanti in questo seminario. Ringrazio particolarmente i relatori di ieri e di oggi e concretamente a voi, Eccellenze, per le vostre riflessioni, per la vostra condivisione e per la vostra disponibilità anche a rispondere le domande che non erano previste. Grazie di cuore. Sono veramente grato agli organizzatori di questo seminario, la Pontificia Università Antoniana, l'ISSE di Venezia, il Centro Pro Unione e l'Ufficio di Giustizia e Pace e Integrità del Creato della nostra Curia Generalissima. Seminario che ci consente di incontrarci in questo auditorio antoniano per riflettere su un tema di profonda attualità, ecumenismo come fondamento della pace, e particolarmente sul tema il ruolo della religione nella costruzione della pace. In questo contesto voglio dire una parola partendo di una iniziativa di Giovanni Paolo II nel 1986, che non ho dubbio a definire profetica. Mi riferisco all'incontro avvenuto ad Assisi con i leader delle principali religioni per riflettere e pregare per la pace. Iniziativa questa che verrà riproposta dall'attuale Pontefice Benedetto XVI proprio in questo anno con motivo del 25° anniversario di quella iniziativa di Giovanni Paolo II. A lui, Benedetto XVI, vada la nostra profonda gratitudine per aver accolto benevolmente l'invito che insieme al Vescovo di Assisi abbiamo fatto i quattro ministri generali del primo ordine e del Toro proprio il 4 ottobre 2010. Il mondo che abbiamo sotto gli occhi vive con l'incubo del terrorismo e disseminato di guerre regionali. È rispetto a questo quadro che possiamo individuare una prima grande merenza di Giovanni Paolo II. Se è vero da una parte che l'iniziativa del 1986 poco ha conseguito rispetto al traguardo della pace, è tuttavia stata importante perché a tutti fosse chiaro che non è la religione in quanto tale a portare problemi alla pace. Dopo la guerra fredda, che sarebbe finita di lì a poco con il crollo dell'impero sovietico, si poteva correre il rischio che la conflittualità presente sul globo assumesse motivazioni di scontro, di civiltà, di cultura e persino di religione, una volta caduta la motivazione dominante del contrasto tra i due grandi sistemi economici e ideologici del marxismo e del liberalismo. Chi non vede oggi questo rischio? Riemergendo la religione negli assetti regionali in conflitto, soprattutto quando la religione si vena di fanatismo e fondamentalismo, si rischia di comprendere il conflitto stesso come frutto della differenza religiosa. Giovanni Paolo II ebbe il merito di promuovere una sensibilizzazione tempestiva sul fatto che la religione di per sé non può che essere foriera di pace. Ma su quale base Giovanni Paolo II ha sviluppato questa intuizione? Essa affonda le radici nella teologia dell'esperienza religiosa, attingendo la motivazione di fondo del rapporto pace-religione alla nostra etate, documento del Vaticano II, lì dove essa abita come orizzonte comune delle religioni, il riferimento alla paternità di Dio, da cui nessun uomo è escluso, e che ci rende tutti fratelli, per cui la preghiera, in quanto è riconoscimento e pratica di un rapporto filiale con Dio, non può che ridondare a vantaggio di una condivisa fraternità. Su questa base poggia per il cristianesimo e per tutte le religioni il principio che, cito a Benedetto XVI, a nessuno è lecito assumere il motivo della differenza religiosa come presupposto o pretesto di un atteggiamento belicoso verso gli altri esseri umani. Fine citazione. Posta la tesi, come rispondere a una ovvia obiezione? E cioè, come spiegare allora le guerre delle religioni? Anche la Bibbia, come noto nell'Antico Testamento, conosce l'idea della guerra santa, in cui Dio combatte per il suo popolo, e tra le regole di tale guerra c'è persino l'obbligo dello sterminio dei nemici, in funzione della santità del popolo di Dio. L'Europa ha conosciuto guerre di religione anche tra i cristiani. Più complessa ancora è l'interpretazione del movimento crociato. Comunque lo si voglia storicamente leggere, esso vede su fronti contrapposti credenti di due grandi religioni, che in nome delle diverse visioni dell'unico Dio e pregando ciascuno per la propria vittoria, si confrontano in un lungo periodo di passione e di sangue. Di fronte a questo scenario, credo non dobbiamo scandalizzarci troppo da credenti. Di certe credine laicista, poco disposta a passare sotto silenzio la violenza di cui è disseminata la nostra storia religiosa. Di fronte a questa problematica, il Papa Benedetto XVI offre una linea interpretativa che tocca l'essenza stessa della religione nella sua concretizzazione storica, e non è di poco conto anche per comprendere la fede biblico-cristiana e l'ermeneutica del criterio storico evolutivo. Il Papa lo usa quando distingue uno stadio maturo e uno stadio immaturo della religione stessa. La guerra santa, le guerre di religione, appartengono a questo stadio immaturo delle religioni. Questo principio storico-evolutivo, evocato dal Papa Benedetto per dichiarare il carattere religiosamente immaturo del concetto di guerra santa, è posto sul crinale di un discernimento che può vedere l'animo religioso slittare su un versante o sull'altro, peccando per eccesso o per difetto. Per difetto peccano le tendenze fondamentaliste, caratterizzate dall'incapacità di accostarsi al testo sacro con la necessaria mediazione storico-critica. Per eccesso peccano le tendenze ermeneutiche che, portandosi oltre i confini del rispetto del nucleo fondamentale e irrinunciabile della fede, finiscono per scardinare lo stesso mondo. Ponendo il criterio storico-evolutivo come principio di discernimento del rapporto cristianesimo-guerra-pace, è ovviamente ben lontano dalla mente del Papa Benedetto il relativismo modernista condannato dalla Chiesa nel 1907 con l'enciclica Pascente. L'interpretazione storico-evolutiva declinata sul principio della storia della salvezza mette anzi in rilievo il vertice della rivelazione, anche se bisogna riconoscere che lo stesso punto vertice, per quanto ormai posto per sempre per noi cristiani nella storia di Gesù di Nazaret, ha bisogno di essere approfondito sotto l'azione dello Spirito che porta alla pienezza della verità. È appunto questo cammino di approfondimento che consente il dialogo dei cattolici con le altre confessioni cristiane e dei cattolici cristiani con le altre religioni, e fa sì che non sia soltanto un dialogo di facciata, ma una vera ricerca di approfondimento della verità, già che le luci dello Spirito possono giungere da tanti parti. Esse verranno tuttavia colte come luce dello Spirito nella misura della loro convergenza con la rivelazione biblica. Voglio finire facendo riferimento a un centenario che si avvicina. Nel 2018 faremo memoria del viaggio di Francesco ad America. In un contesto, questo viaggio, di profondo scontro tra cristiani e musulmani. Francesco si presenta davanti al sultano semplicemente come un credente e trova nella persona del Bene del Camino un altro credente. E allora avviene il miracolo. Il miracolo del dialogo e dell'incontro che ha permesso a noi, frati minori, conosciuti nel Medio Oriente come frati della corda, di essere presenti ininterrottamente in quella terra fino ad oggi. alla luce di questo evento veramente profetico, Francesco è un profeta del dialogo e dell'incontro con l'altro, col diverso, anche dal punto di vista della fede. Alla luce di questo evento si può capire molto bene un'affermazione di Benedetto XVI. Le manifestazioni, dice il Papa, di violenza non possono attribuirsi alla religione in quanto tale, ma ai limiti culturali con cui essa viene vissuta e si sviluppa nel tempo. Quando però il senso religioso raggiunge una sua maturità, genera nel credente la percezione che la fede in Dio, creatore dell'universo e padre di tutti, non può non promuovere tra gli uomini relazione di universale fraternità. Possa Francesco illuminare il nostro cammino di dialogo e di artigiani della pace e del bene. Grazie.